From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a report quantifies the rise in reckless driving in Milwaukee.
Then why parents of Montessori school students wouldn't have it any other way.
I would probably say it gives you the strength and education and independence to be an individual. And it's beautiful. It would be that simple.
Why some birds find Wisconsin a charming winter getaway.
And contributor Dave Kozlowski explains why the concept of buying local is more than just a marketing ploy.
They say know your farmer, know your food. I think that's true. Once you can know your farmer, I think that gives you a greater sense of security, integrity about the food, just a greater sense of worth to the food that you're feeding.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. For a long time, traffic accidents and related fatalities were falling in Milwaukee. Well, that made sense as cars got safer and traffic technology improved. But a few years ago, things started moving in the other direction.
As just about anyone who drives in Milwaukee can attest, it seems like the roads are a more dangerous place to be these days. And the statistics bear that out. A recent investigative report in the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service quantifies the problem and looks for explanations. Elliot Hughes reported the story, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
So I think many drivers might be under the impression that things are getting more dangerous on the roads. But what's the evidence out there that shows that this is more than just a hunch?
In the early 2010s, it seems like this started to develop. 2010 is about when the calls for service for reckless driving started increasing year after year. In 2012, that's when injury crashes started increasing year after year. So those two things have been on the rise for a while. Traffic fatalities, meanwhile, took a little longer to become an issue. Those started really jumping in 2014 when 49 people died. From 1996 through 2013, there was about 30 to 40 people typically that would die a year. 2014, there was 49. 2015, there was 64. 2016, 57. And last year, 64 again. So,
are there specific areas in the city that are the most dangerous spots to drive?
There are a couple. This is an issue that everyone acknowledges is throughout the city. I myself have witnessed people running red lights and speeding and driving in bicycle lanes in every part of the city. But the north side does seem to have some of the worst of it. That's where most of the fatalities are. And that's where two of the biggest culprits, the two most dangerous streets in the city are. That's West Capitol Drive and West Fond du Lac Avenue. For 2016, the MPD, they acknowledged 56 intersections in the city that they described as high-frequency crash locations. Eight of the top 10 intersections are along West Capitol Drive and Fond du Lac Avenue.
And to distinguish themselves as high-frequency crash intersections, it's like 15 or more per year, is
that's
that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Which is a lot of crashes in one place.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the MPD. Where do they fit in the dynamic? I know their pursuit policy has changed over the years in a couple of ways, right?
That's right. In 2010, they narrowed their pursuit policy, and it said that officers could pursue a subject if there was probable cause that the vehicle or the occupants were connected to a violent felony. And that was in response to several innocent bystanders in the years prior had been killed during police pursuits. Police pursuits are understood to be one of the most dangerous events that a police officer can engage in. So there is an interest in narrowing that down. But a lot of members of the community and city officials believe that that policy was too narrow, and it communicated to the public that there were offenses for which they would likely not receive consequences. So a lot of people believe that the public took advantage of that.
Well, so and that's kind of the effect end of it. Let's talk a bit about the causes. I mean, you're right that there are not direct quantifiable answers as to exactly why there is more reckless driving. But there are a few explanations out there that a lot of people talked about. What did your sources say, were the main reasons or the main factors that may be playing a role here?
one thing that I hear probably the most often, if it's not the pursuit policy, which has since changed in September, the Police and Fire Commission forced MPD to widen the scope, and now they are allowed to pursue for reckless driving and other offenses. But other than that, the one I hear most often is just youth culture, the idea of, you know, if you're in high school, it's cool that you have a car and it's cool to drive around aimlessly. The idea is that that has now evolved to it's cool to steal cars and drive with reckless abandon. And then there's another aspect to this, too. There's this idea that youth in Milwaukee are so disadvantaged that they grow up believing that they're not going to live past, you know, their early 20s. And so if you live a life like that where you're told you're not going to live very long, perhaps then you don't think so much about consequences of your actions.
And along those lines as well, you also write that things like driver's ed are not as common as they mm-hmm. once were, and there seem to be a greater number of people driving without licenses at all.
Yeah, there was a UWM study in 2015. This was in response to, in 2004, the state government stopped funding schools to provide driver's ed, and since then, the onus to pay this has fallen a little bit more on the public. It's therefore not as accessible as it once was for low-income students. And this study said that 83% of black male teens in Milwaukee don't have a license, and most low-income teens don't have a license either. And there's disagreement about how much driver's education would impact this phenomenon. There's an Alderman Khalif Rainey who pointed out that, you know, you don't need to take driver's ed to realize that you shouldn't drive through a red light. So there's some disagreement about that.
So what was the surge, as it's been called, and what effect did that have?
Yeah, in October, MPD announced this new strategy. They called it the traffic surge. What they did was they determined 56 locations throughout the city that had a high confluence of traffic offenses, violent crime, and just general disorder. And they were going to increase police presence in those areas. And they, after 60 days, you know, this was a temporary strategy. And after 60 days, they updated the public on the results, and they were encouraging. It's a small sample size, but they said that stops that resulted in tickets jumped 111% when you compare the 62 days of the surge to the 62 days prior. Car crashes fell 9%, and crashes in the surge area specifically dropped 12%. And now that's a small sample size. Flynn wanted this to become a permanent strategy for combating reckless driving. Flynn has since retired, and the interim chief, Alfonso Morales, has said publicly that he doesn't think the surge is working. So it's unclear if this really will become a permanent solution.
Do you get the sense, then, that there's anything else that people are exploring, either through law enforcement or legislative means?
Yes, in a state representative from Milwaukee, David Crowley, he's been trying to pass a state law that would allow Milwaukee to have automated traffic cameras, which would photograph a license plate if it runs a red light, for example. There's many community members who are just trying to encourage people to hold each other accountable. MPD, other than describing their surge, they haven't been too descriptive about other initiatives.
What are the things that strike that maybe stay with you most about the story as you reported it?
Probably the incident that I witnessed in October. It was at an intersection of 12th and Concordia Street. In October, there was an accident where a 16-year-old boy was thrown from the top of a moving vehicle. It seems as if him and the driver were goofing around. And the day after, numerous community members and some state representatives were there, too. There were about 40 people. They held a press conference where they just wanted to plead to the public to slow down and be more considerate. And there's about 40 people at this intersection. It's a four-way stop. There's kids there, too. And they were interrupted by a SUV that came speeding down the street. It went right through the intersection, didn't stop. Two police officers were on hand. They jumped on their motorcycles and gave chase down an alleyway. About a half hour later, the two officers returned, said that the driver jumped out of the car and ran away. You know, it really just speaks to the tall task at hand here. There were 40 people at this intersection. It's a four-way stop, and this driver didn't care, simply just drove right through, and perhaps he was arrested weeks later, but he got away that day.
You write the term that people use is red light roulette.
Yeah, Alderman Khalif Rainey. He's an alderman of a district who has seen some of the most traffic fatalities over the last 2 years. He calls this phenomenon red light roulette. He said that in the morning when he says goodbye to his wife, who drives his child to school, he tells her to be careful. And, you know, he told me that he's nervous sometimes when he's approaching an intersection and there's a green light, because if he can't see what's coming from the other directions, perhaps there's someone who's not paying attention or simply doesn't care.
Well, Elliot Hughes, thank you so much for sharing the story. Nice work.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Elliot Hughes is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find his coverage of reckless driving in Milwaukee at WUWM.com. And of course, that is where you can also find a place to make your contribution on day one of our winter membership drive. I'm Bonnie North in the studio with Mitch Teich, and it is a great day to start, isn't it?
It really is. And you mentioned WUWM.com. That's also where you can see a picture of the great item we have available when you make a contribution to WUWM today. For today only, when you support us between now and a minute before midnight, 11:59 p.m., you're entered into a drawing to win one of 10 lightweight NPR hoodies. And, you know, the weather's kind of fluctuating, but by the time this ends up in your hands, it'll be just the right item for spring in Milwaukee.
It is always the right time to wear something that shows your love of WUWM, of Milwaukee's NPR, and tangentially of Lake Effect as well. We are looking for 10 new or renewing sustaining members today, and that can be any amount you want, $5 a month, $10 a month. The important thing is that you make your contribution and it comes out of your checking account or your credit card monthly. You never have to think about it again, and we get to use the money to bring programming like this to you.
Right. The equation is not very complicated. Your contributions directly help bring you reporting that helps you understand the community where you live, whether it's traffic fatalities in Milwaukee or the story about Montessori education that's coming up a little bit later on, or it's arts coverage. It's all the things you come to depend on each and every day on Lake Effect. And you make it happen when you call 414-227-3210 or you visit us at WUWM.com/give.
We will take a short break, and then education reporter Rachel Morello takes us to a local Montessori school for this week's Beats Me. It's the segment that lets you ask the questions. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin has a complicated school scene. The largest parental choice program in the country calls Milwaukee home, but the state boasts a wide variety of other educational offerings as well, so many that you might not recognize some of them.
There are plenty of families who take advantage of non-traditional forms of schooling here, including a healthy selection of Montessori schools. Well, and you might wonder, what is a Montessori school and what sets it apart from a quote-unquote regular school?
And you would not be alone. Several WUWM listeners wrote in with those very same questions. So Lake Effect's Rachel Morello dug into Montessori for this month's Beats Me segment that lets you ask the questions.
To give us a visual of Montessori education, Rachel visited Nature's Classroom Montessori School in Mukwonago, where she met with a group of parents whose children learn or have learned according to the Montessori model.
Rachel started by asking them, how do you describe how your kids are learning through Montessori to friends or family?
Choice within structure. A lot of freedom to choose and follow your interests, but a specific structure so that there's a curriculum that must be followed, but you kind of get to choose your own path in following it.
When people ask you at first, are they kind of skeptical sounding, or what's sort of the, like...
A lot of people have a misconception that children just do whatever they want to, and it's chaos, and they just play all day.
It's not a free-for-all.
Right, not a free-for-all.
It's not a free-for-all. They very much can choose their own path, but the great thing about Montessori is that children aren't held back. They learn at their own pace. So if a child struggles with reading but excels in math, they may go through the math curriculum really quickly, but take the time that they need and get the additional help that they need in that reading area. So it's not a free-for-all in any way, shape, or form. The materials that are there are meant to help them learn in a concrete kind of way and help them where they are developmentally. That's what I think is really different between this and regular school, is the developmental appropriateness of Montessori as opposed to public school, where it's everybody's kind of learning at the same time. I teach teachers. That's why I'm here, though. I wanted to go to a place where it was a philosophy I agreed with. That's the biggest reason we chose here, is because it was something different than what we did, and I knew it was a tried and tested educational philosophy.
Cindy, I'll ask you, because your daughter's moved on from Montessori now.
When she talks about her experiences here at Nature's Classroom, this allowed her the experience to be herself and to, like what Tina said, grow at her own pace, which she needed at the time.
Yeah, where did she go before she came here?
Public school. And our other younger daughter is there too, and I truly believe that learning is so individual. And so this worked for Dakota. Public school works for my other daughter.
Can you talk a little bit about how your student talks about how they learn and how they interact with their work?
While they were talking, I was thinking another really distinctive thing about Montessori is that the kids are grouped. So when we say children's house, that's ages 3 to 6. And the 5 and 6-year-olds and the 4-year-olds, they're all teaching each other. So my daughter, when she was 4, started giving lessons to the 3-year-olds. And, you know, the teachers aren't helping that with that. It's all the students kind of passing on their learning. And I think that's a really great thing for the kids, because in some ways it might be less intimidating than having a teacher teaching you something. There's also not a lot of overcorrection if they do something wrong. My daughter is a huge perfectionist, to the point where if she thinks she might do something wrong, she won't even try it the first time. So for Montessori, that there wasn't that pressure, in that if she pronounced something wrong or read something wrong, they didn't immediately stop her and say, oh, nope, it's this, because that would have just completely shut her down. So it really built her confidence and enabled her, I think, to learn and to grow faster than I think she would have in a normal school, where maybe she had been taking a test, written something down, she got it wrong, and then she would just lose interest in that or kind of shut down.
Have any of your children really grown in an area that you weren't expecting because they've gone to Montessori school?
So many areas. I was just with some family in the fall, and my son went through the entire solar system, and then he explained to my mother about Pluto, and then if you were looking at it, you'd have a hard time finding it because of all the other asteroids around it. And he's 4. And that's just one example. There are so many examples where you just give them like a little nibble of something, even at home, and they'll just take it and it'll totally become their own. I mean, it works to the advantage of the child, because when you can mold them that way at such a young age, then that's knowledge they'll have forever. He'll know about Pluto for the rest of his life.
Mold them that way is in the way that they choose to be molded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first 7 years of Montessori is just the children learning how they learn.
I think one of the most important things for anybody, you know, at any age, is trying to find your passion. And the Montessori curriculum allows them to find that at such an early age, to build that confidence, to find that passion, which is really an unbelievable thing. But you have your learning bell curve, if you will, and the, you know, traditional education aligns with, I mean, the average. I mean, you have some sliver right in the middle, and that's what who they accommodate, which is fine for that, if you fit into that sliver. But anybody that's on either side of that, that's where the Montessori system really comes into play, is the, you know, the ones that are being held back or the ones that need a little bit additional assistance.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you found when people are asking you about it?
For sure. It's that they are not as socialized as other groups of children. Anyone to sit down and watch these children for even 15 minutes in their classroom outside, it's a thing, or that, it's a thing of beauty. So that was something that really surprised me, is as they would be working individually, they also would have so much social interaction. So it's miles ahead, if you ask me, compared to what I went through as a kindergarten, first grade, second grader.
when I was in high school and I was in middle school, there were three or four people that I hung out with regularly. It wasn't like I had this 20 kids that, you know, were my best friends that I always hung out with. The other thing that I think is a huge differentiator is, I mean, as soon as, even when they're three, it's you carry your own backpack, you get your own things, you hang your own things. No, you know, you don't have adults doing that for you, and they really reinforce that. And that was hard for me as a parent not to try to do it all for them, but it's hugely beneficial. And they use glass, they don't use plastic cups, they don't worry about them breaking things. It's if you break it, then you clean it up, and that's what happens. But it teaches them from early on to be careful and to how to handle things and to how to deal with those situations when they do happen. So it's not a huge tantrum and meltdown if she breaks a glass. It's people break things, accidents happen, and she takes care of it.
They're allowed to take risks. Physically, they're allowed to climb trees here. I just was speaking with a child the other day who was complaining that the balls had been taken off the playground because somebody got hit. Here, you know, if you fall down, you get a bump, maybe you learn to be more careful next time. So they can climb trees, they can go sledding, they can play on the ice, and they can take risks academically. If they have an area they're passionate about, go to the library, find out information. There are no boundaries as far as learning goes. So I just think it, and I think for my son, it's given him a level of confidence physically, socially, and academically. I don't think he sees limits. I think he feels like if he wants to do it, he can go out and he can do it.
With all these people asking the question of our station to explain what Montessori is, and if you had to pitch Montessori to a parent who'd never heard of it before, how would you do it?
I would probably say it gives you the strength and education and independence to be an individual. And it's beautiful. It would be that simple.
I guess I would have to say I wish I could have been a Montessori student. Yeah.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello spoke with parents whose students attend Nature's Classroom Montessori School in Mukwonago.
They included Cindy Purnell, Tina Melzel, Colleen Ryan, Heather and Caro, Hillary Bowser, Tim Guild, and Marsha Modin.
You can find more about Montessori education in Wisconsin and read Rachel's story on our website, wuwm.com.
Winter has another full month to run in Wisconsin, and with it, the winter stay for some feathered friends that actually find their way to Wisconsin this time of year. They seek out the frost-laden forests and prairies around the state, even as their fellow birds have gone south.
Lindsay Obermeyer is the manager of the Raptor Program at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, and she joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio last month to talk about why Wisconsin is an ideal winter destination for some birds.
We do notice, you know, the lack of birds as they migrate south, but for some birds, Wisconsin is south for them. And so, yeah, they come down here. They can be seen in our bird feeders. They can be seen in big fields. And we can keep our eyes just as peeled in the winter as we do during the summertime.
What kinds of birds end up coming into Wisconsin for the winter?
So we'll find a lot of birds that are more from northern Canada and the Arctic. Even smaller birds like purple finches and red poles, pine siskins will come in. So these are little birds we can continue to feed at our feeders. And then the ones that really get a lot of attention are the larger birds that are much more noticeable, like our raptor friends. So our raptors, when we say that, I'm talking about hawks and owls and like eagles and falcons. Those are what we consider raptors. And especially in the wintertime, one of the most popular raptors that comes into Wisconsin is the snowy owl, because they're so strikingly beautiful. So they come and visit us, as well as northern harriers, rough-legged hawks, and we can enjoy seeing them here while they spend their winters with us.
One of my colleagues was actually saying that he and his son had seen about 3 snowy owls this winter, and that's part of why we're having this conversation.
Yeah, we are in the middle of a very large eruption year for snowy owls. And so when I say that, the word eruption, we can think of it as invasion almost. So these birds aren't necessarily migrating like our sandhill cranes would migrate. It is actually tied to a high food availability during the breeding season in the Arctic. So this past summer, snowy owls had a lot of food up there. They really like to eat lemmings, which are a small rodent. So there were a lot of lemmings, which means that the adult breeding snowies were able to produce more chicks. So what happens then, when it's wintertime like now, those first-year birds have to leave because there's no territory for them to find food. So they will come and visit us here in Wisconsin. We have such a large number this year. The last number that I heard were 200 individuals of snowies in Wisconsin. They've actually been seen in 63 of our 72 counties in the state. Very high numbers. And it's exciting to see it. It happens about every 4 years.
How many counties around Milwaukee have they been seen in?
Almost all of them, yeah. If you want to think about where these birds are going to be found, it's pretty much open landscapes. So think about where they are, where they can live in the Arctic, large open spaces. They'll be found in grasslands, open marshland, and here in the along the lakefront. A couple come down and hang out here in downtown Milwaukee, where they can look over the lake, and there's large areas to look. And these are the areas that they'll prefer. So as long as, you know, they have that and they can hunt appropriately, they'll hang out in those areas.
What is it about Wisconsin during the winter that makes it attractive to both the songbirds and the raptors?
That's a very good question. we see our winter birds primarily because we fall just right in that pathway of them. They can just continue to follow things south until they find habitat that's suitable for their food, especially these smaller songbirds who during the summertime will eat insects and seeds. They'll come down here and continue to eat our seed. But they come down to Wisconsin. They're also found like along the East Coast, the New England area. But we have these large expansive lands, farmlands, where especially like our raptors can continue to find their prey, their rodents that they need, and they prefer to they prefer to be here. Maybe they like the Packers. You know, they're Packer fans.
Big Packer fans, yeah. are there any local birds or birds that we think of as being local in spring and summer that do winter over and are still active in Wisconsin?
Oh, most definitely. There's just few of them. What they're actually finding with some raptor populations that used to be migrants, which means that every winter they would leave, some of our raptor populations like our peregrine falcons and our American kestrels, they'll actually stay here now because they are able to find their food. As long as a bird or an animal in general can find food and it has proper shelter, it wants to stay where it lives. So so we can see, like these raptors, we can see red-tailed hawks throughout the year. Our bald eagles stay here throughout the entire year. We can just see them kind of using different areas depending on where the food availability is.
So if you're someone who is brave enough to venture out into the cold in Milwaukee or the kind of surrounding areas and go bird watching, where should you go?
If you're brave enough, and there are many of us out there that are, it depends on what you're looking for, really. And a great way to go birding in the winter is by using your own vehicle as your birding blind. So here in Milwaukee, you can go down to the ferry, stay in your car, and see what kind of raptors and water birds, shorebirds you can see. But there are other areas. So the Buena Vista grasslands are another place. A lot of our natural areas, like Horicon Marsh, you want to kind of just check out these natural national and state parks, and that's where you can see these guys. And you can sit in your car, stay warm, sip your coffee, and go birding.
All right. Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us about birds in winter in the Milwaukee area. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Obermeyer is the Raptor Program Manager at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And while there are a lot of Wisconsin people who go south during the winter and call themselves snowbirds, we are glad that you are not among them because you are here in southeastern Wisconsin listening to us on Lake Effect each and every day. You might be streaming us. You might be in Arizona right now or Florida. But in any case, we are grateful that you are listeners and will be even more grateful if you or when you become a member. We are into day one of our 2018 winter member drive, and you can play a role in it by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting us at wuwm.com/give. And while you're there, take advantage of our special offer today only.
Our special offer today only is when you support us between now and just before midnight, 11:59 p.m., you'll automatically be entered into a drawing to win one of 10 lightweight NPR hoodies. And this is a gray-colored super soft hoodie with a blend of cotton and polyester. It's got a suede finish.
So you need suede
finish. A unique suede finish. It's very soft and feels really good.
Your cat will like it?
Your cat will like it. It is a unisex hoodie, so men or women, it doesn't matter. It features an embroidered NPR logo, some ribbed cuffs, and a ribbed hem. So it's going to be a very sartorially stylish, stylish way of saying, I support the programming I hear on Milwaukee's NPR. That is 89.7 WUWM. You listen, you know you depend on this program, you know you appreciate this programming, and this is the way you can support it. And we are trying to get 10. We're so close, Mitch. We need 10 people this hour.
New or renewing members.
That's right. And we are looking for member numbers. The amount of money that you donate is completely up to you. Whatever you can afford, whatever fits into your budget. If you can become a sustaining member, that's a very cool thing, too, because that means you kind of set it and forget it, and you know that you're supporting us all the time.
We are a locally growing radio program, a locally growing radio station. And one last break, and then we'll talk about the locally grown equation when it comes to food. Lake Effect contributor Dave Kozlowski joins us when we return on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Homegrown, native, seasonal, all of those are big buzzwords in the food industry, especially for the grocers and the restaurants who use them as a marketing tool. But why should you care about whether an apple is local, as in picked from a farm up the road, or local as grown in the United States?
One person who believes strongly that real localism makes a big difference is contributor Dave Kozlowski. He and his wife, Sandy Rodens, operate the organic produce farm Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek, a farm that is most definitely local. It's a term, Kozlowski tells Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, that means something different to everyone.
The Wikipedia definition of local, the one that they go by, is 100 miles. And a lot of folks sort of use that as a standard measure. So if you're buying something within that 100-mile radius, you're saying you're buying something within local. That seems pretty limiting, really, because it depends on where you're located. So I think local is kind of like the definition of beauty. It's sort of what you think is important to buy locally. Some people would bristle at buying even California wine because there's Wisconsin wineries. They're not the same. So people will buy California because it's better than buying a French wine or a Spanish wine. I drink coffee. I love chocolate. At least the raw product of those products aren't going to come from this country within 100 miles or 500 miles or 1,000 miles. It's coming from across the world. So am I going to give up chocolate and coffee because it's not local? Don't bet your life. Not going to do that.
True.
So it really just depends. And I've got a farmer perspective, so I'm really more interested in what a consumer perspective is. So I want to throw that back to you. I mean, what's your definition of local?
I would consider the state of Wisconsin.
Okay.
To be local. I mean, ideally, it's within the surrounding counties, but we're in Milwaukee. There has to be distance to get out to these farms or these creameries or anything like that. So generally, if it's like, oh, made in Wisconsin product, I would consider that benefiting the local market.
And I think that's a good definition because you've got a lot to choose from in Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin's a leader in so many ways, organic and conventional, that yeah, why not? That's
yeah, so let's go into that. You know, what is Wisconsin's role in organic farming, dairy, meat, and produce? Does it stand above most other states within the U.S.?
It does. It does. In fact, it is like the number one in dairy, that's really quite a credit to the state, given California's size. California would be number two. We're number three in the number of acres in organic production. We're number five in sales of organic products. We're number one in eggs and meat, and we're number one in produce for the organic products. Yeah. So Wisconsin is really quite a leader in this area.
And that's not something we often hear about.
No, we don't, and we should be trumping it up. And when you look at the farmer statistics on who wants to get into organic by how much land that they want to transition over into the National Organic Program, that's increasing in Wisconsin. It's not staying the same even. It's increasing. So we're looking to produce more and more organic products out of Wisconsin. So for those people who consider the state of Wisconsin as the local area of their interest, increasingly you're going to have more to choose from, both organically and conventionally.
Right. And with all of this resources within the state of organic, especially more grocery stores, say Aldi's, Sendix, even restaurants, Culver's Cousins, you know, they tout selling local, or Aldi is starting to do more and more organic produce, organic sections. But there is a power of advertising behind that, kind of similar to how something's labeled fat-free and healthy, but really that just hides more unhealthful practices within it. So how can we as consumers fact check this, and what is local, with where places are getting their source?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no like yuck sticker that we can put on things that says, you know, this is local or this is not local. Largely because what we originally started talking about is the definition is so fluid. So how can you fact check these things? Well, we do know that given surveys of the Grocery Manufacturers or Grocery Something Association, I forget what the name is, that shoppers at grocery stores want more and more local organic products. They like it because it helps the economy, they believe. They like it because they think it offers a broader assortment. It's healthier, helps the environment, all these kinds of things. Question is, given where these products are laid out in a grocery store, how do you know which is local, which is organic, which is not? Some stores separate them. I didn't know this. I don't do the grocery shopping. My wife does. But Woodman's separates out organic products from non-organic, and they label the local stuff. You go to the Outpost, for instance, they will label the stuff and sometimes even the farm that they got it from for some of their products. So those are good ways of indicating. One way, not in the grocery stores, in the restaurants, would be to ask the wait staff. If it's a restaurant that's run honestly, with integrity, they will educate their wait staff as to who their suppliers are. If they're stumbling, if they don't know, go to the kitchen, ask the chef, ask somebody. You know, if you're really concerned about this, go online. There's probably Yelp reviews or something about restaurants that are buying more local and touting it. So there's no easy way, I guess, is the short answer. The consumer, it's caveat emptor, right? Mm-hmm. Because the consumer has to do a little bit of research on this. You either have to talk to the produce manager at the grocery store or to the wait staff or the owner of the restaurant. You're going to have to find this out. But I think it's important to take that extra step, because by doing that, you're expressing your interest. And by expressing your interest, you're going to raise the interest of the owner of that grocery store or restaurant, and they're going to pursue more organic local products.
So do you think we need a working definition across the U.S., either set by the FDA or something, to secure and regulate this practice so that there is more transparency? Or do you think that kind of falls into the micromanagement of farms across the country?
Yeah, I think it kind of does, because it's going to be really hard. You know, who's sitting on that board? If it's a bunch of folks from California, oh, heck, fire. They'll say 50 miles because they can pretty much get anything they want in California. You know, if it's somebody in upstate Maine, it's going to be a different definition. So I just think it's, as I said before, it's just too fluid of a kind of thing. It's a beauty thing, and you're just going to have to decide for yourselves. And I actually think that works fine. You know, that's really the heart and soul of a free market system, right? People are going to decide for themselves what they think is local, rather than, not that I'm anti-government, but not that, you know, the government needs to micromanage that definition.
Right. And with people deciding what's important to them, how can farmers or stores, anything that is selling local products, how do they make people care about it if it's not on their radar already?
That's a good question. Well, I can only say of the folks that we know, particularly in the restaurant side, that they will advertise it how else could they market it? I don't know. I wish they would market it more. You know, I know a couple of restaurants where, and I'm not mentioning the name, because it happens to be a friend of mine, but the restaurant has got pictures of all the farms they deal with. I think that's a really neat way to personalize the fact that they're buying local food, not just from a warehouse, not just from Reinhard Cisco or another distributor, but from an actual farmer. And they're proud enough of it that they actually have their picture or, in some cases, the names of the farms in the restaurant. Grocery stores, I think Outposts does a wonderful job of that. I think the more they can point out that this comes from an individual farm, that's an individual farmer that's got a face on it, that I think that works better for them and for the consumer. I think they say know your farmer, know your food. I think that's true. Once you can know your farmer, I think that gives you a greater sense of security, integrity about the food, greater knowledge about where it's coming from, just a greater sense of worth to the food that you're feeding.
Well, we've touched upon how if you go to a farmer's market and you buy something there, you're more inclined to actually make a meal with that, mm-hmm. you know, versus letting it go bad in the fridge or wherever else. But in addition to farmer's market, what are some ways in which communities can access, quote, local foods?
Besides the grocery stores mm-hmm. and the restaurants and the farmer's markets, a lot of farms have programs called CSA programs. And CSA is an abbreviation. It stands for Community Supported Agriculture. I'm always surprised, since our farm itself has been doing this for 24 years, I'm always surprised that there are people out there that still don't know about it or heard about it.
Right. According to localharvest.org, there's only about 23 CSAs serving Milwaukee and the surrounding areas.
Mm-hmm. That's about right. Yeah.
That's I was surprised to find that.
Yeah. You go to the Madison area and there's probably about 50. So twice as many, probably half the size of the population. So, yeah, it's not quite as well known in the greater Milwaukee area, southeastern Wisconsin. It's a program that farms offer where the community, members of the community, can actually become members to a farm. And one of the perks of being a member of a farm is that the farmer will produce a certain amount of produce for you every week. The traditional form of the CSA is one where they pack a box for you, and then they deliver that box of vegetables to a convenient drop site. Now, like everything else, these programs have been around for 25, 30 years. They're starting to morph into different shapes and forms. Now there are farms that will offer you a choice. You can dial in on their webpage and you can select the items you want for your box. Other farmers will bring a slew of things to a certain site. You can come and pick what you want from that rather than have a box made. So it's changing forms, but in essence, it's the same thing. In essence, it's the community getting to know where their food is growing, feeling a sense of security in knowing how it's grown. You're connecting with a farm. A lot of farms that have CSA programs are near the metropolitan areas because that's where our markets are. So you're saving that farmland, you're preserving that farmland, and you're having access to a way of life that a lot of folks in the city aren't familiar with anymore. It's no longer surprising to me to find families come to our farm where kids don't realize that the carrots grow underground, that beans come on a plant that look like a flower, basically, or a shrub. And that's a little surprising to us farmers, but it shouldn't be, I guess, because we are generations removed from being farmers ourselves. And the other nice thing about CSA programs is it puts more of the money of your food dollar directly in the pocket of the producer. It was a while ago, 1900 to be exact, when farmers were making about 40 cents on every dollar that people were spending on food. And now it's something less than 7 cents a dollar. Most of the money you spend on food goes to shipping, packaging, warehousing, storing, whatever. When you buy direct from the farmer, whether it's a farmer's market or through a CSA program, then you're putting your food dollars that you were going to spend wherever directly into the pockets of the producer of that food.
And to play a consumer devil's advocate, is it about the same economically to invest in a CSA versus going to Pick and Save and getting the same thing?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I could say this, because this is based on a USDA study. It's a USDA-funded study done by the Iowa State University. What they did was they took a basket of goods that were locally produced by the farmers there in Iowa and a basket bought from the grocery store. And in every case, in every community they went to, they found that the locally produced produce was cheaper than the grocery store produce, say. And I'd have to say that's probably about right with the CSA programs as well. We don't do it all the time. We don't do it as much as we used to. And I'm sure we're not the only farm that does this. But we look at what we're delivering and we compare it to what the grocery store prices are. And we're usually in the ballpark with that. So is it more expensive? Over the long haul, no. What makes CSAs a little bit tricky, and if there's a con to this business, this is it. The money generally is paid up front. So you are taking a bit of a risk with the farmer on the season. So if it's going to be a really bad season, and although you had planned to deliver tomatoes, you know, in 8 of your boxes, it was a bad season, you only delivered 4, you took a little bit of a loss on that. But every year is different. There's always good things and always bad things in every year. And by doing that also, you're helping the farmer by not having the farmer go to a bank. Because most farms have to go to a bank to pull an operating loan. Your CSA program can be at least partially an operating loan for the farm because you're getting the money up front in the beginning of the year.
Now, what about wintertime? Things aren't growing necessarily. A lot are in storage. CSA programs generally don't deliver in the winter. So what's a good way for people to keep sustaining a local food practice?
Well, two things. Go to the winter market. Folks have gone to Milwaukee, has a really nice winter market at the Domes. It's in a greenhouse behind the Domes. There are several produce vendors, meat vendors, cheese vendors there. There's bread. All of it is local, at least using a definition of Wisconsin is local. And that goes on until the outdoor season begins around here in April and May and June. So there's access to that. Now, you have to think of eating seasonally. You're not going to be able to go to the winter market and find strawberries. We don't grow strawberries here in Wisconsin in the wintertime. So you're going to be challenged to eat seasonally. And I think that's a good thing because that increases the variety of foods that you're going to eat. The second thing you can do, and this is putting the onus back on the consumer, is to preserve some of your summer produce. Do a little canning, do a little freezing, do a little dehydrating. Then you'll have those foods available for you in the wintertime when they're not being grown outdoors.
What would you say as a call to action for anyone who's listening who, you know, we've perhaps piqued their interest in changing some of their consumer practices? What would you say to them to start making changes and be a more conscious consumer with the local market?
Oh, just get in there, you know, take those first few steps. If you're not used to buying local organic product, just go out and explore what it looks like. Go to the farmer's market. Go to a restaurant and talk to the chefs about where this came from, and then maybe you can source your own from some of those farmers. It's more than just a commodity then.
Exactly.
And if it's more than a commodity, then perhaps you actually are going to cook it, and you are going to eat it. And I can guarantee that it's going to be fresher and more delicious.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.
Contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek. And contributors like Dave Kozlowski are one of the ways that we use your contributions to broaden the reach of Lake Effect. I mean, there's no way that Mitch and I and Audrey and Joy could possibly cover everything that there is out there happening in southeastern Wisconsin. So we rely on people like Dave who have a specific area of expertise to come in and talk to us about it, and it helps you broaden your understanding of our region.
Yeah, it's a little behind the scenes here. We interview thousands of people every year, and you know, many of them are different people who will only ever get to talk to once. Maybe they're coming through town, or maybe they have a very specific area of expertise. But there are some subjects that we come to again and again, and in those cases, it really makes sense that we depend on a person or a handful of people to share their expertise in that subject, whether it's organic growing or it's gardening in general, or it's astronomy, or it's the life of a classical musician. All of those subjects are subjects for our regular contributors. But we also need to hear from regular contributors of another sort. And those are the regular contributors like you who make this show possible.
We are looking for 10 specifically in this hour to call 414-227-3210 or go to WUWM.com and make a contribution. You're either a new person to us and welcome if you are, or maybe you are a renewing member. Thank you very much for already contributing and for continuing to do so. We'd love to hear from you. 414-227-3210 is the number to call. We also have this hoodie, Mitch.
Right.
Describe that. It's pretty cool.
Don't forget, between now and just before midnight, 11:59 p.m., when you make a contribution, you'll be automatically entered into a drawing to win one of 10 lightweight NPR hoodies. They are gray and super soft, a combination of cotton and polyester, a unique suede finish. It's a great hoodie. It's got the NPR logo on it, and it's a great way. It's something great that you can wear out in public and kind of, you know,
broadcast, as you were,
exactly.
Your support.
Donations are not required to enter to win, but they are surely appreciated. And to do that, make your call now to 414-227-3210 or visit us at wuwm.com/give. That is all for Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. NPR's Fresh Air is next.